From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Another Thursday morning, another round of grim economic news. The Labor Department's weekly tally shows 2.4 million people filed for unemployment last week. That brings the total to nearly 39 million people in America out of work. And economists believe the fallout will last for years to come.
The efforts to mitigate that devastation are happening as we speak. All 50 states are lifting restrictions and people are returning to work. In Mississippi, nearly 16,000 casino workers head back today. This is significant because gaming in Mississippi generates over $2 billion of annual revenue. Mary Perez joins us with the latest from Biloxi, and she is a business and casino reporter for the Biloxi Sun-Herald. Welcome.
Thank you.
So give us the lay of the land, what it was like today for employees who returned to some of those major casinos for the first time in 2 months.
Yeah, it was a little strange for everyone. All the employees here have to wear masks. They were getting used to that. A couple of them said, they've been sleeping in. They had to get up early and come to work. But most of them are just glad to be back. They're glad to have some normal back in their lives.
You were able to go inside of one of the casinos. Tell us more. What was it like?
I was at Golden Nugget Casino in Biloxi, and there were people at all the entrances. They actually opened the hotel last night so that people could, you know, their diehard fans could be there first thing in the morning, because a lot of people were coming from other states that haven't opened. So, you know, they came over from all around, and they were ready to go at 8 a.m. They wanted in.
Oh, wow. So patrons were really eager to go inside. What precautions are the casinos taking to keep people safe?
Oh, the Mississippi Gaming Commission has a long, very long list of things that they have to do. The slot machines have to be positioned so that people stay 6 feet apart. The staff has to have their temperature taken every day. They have to wear masks. There's hand sanitizer stations everywhere. You can hardly walk without bumping into them. Even in the lines this morning, a lot of people were, you know, staying 6 feet apart unless they were like together. Then they you know, stood next to each other. People were very conscious of it. So it's a little different. Somebody said it's kind of weird, but other people said, hey, it's just positioned a little differently. It's okay.
I want to ask you about ventilation systems, because casinos are notorious for being an enclosed space where the air is kind of recycled over time. And there are people who spend hours and hours inside of them. Have gaming officials talked about this, or how they will mitigate this situation in light of the coronavirus?
They haven't, but smoking will be allowed in the casinos. We don't have non-smoking regulated in the casinos. We do have two casinos that are completely non-smoking, but the others will. And they have redundant systems, so they have the air conditioning, and then they have air purification systems too. So whether that's, you know, an extra precaution because they're smoking, I don't know. But no, I haven't talked to anyone about it.
20% of people in Mississippi live below the poverty line. And I mentioned earlier that gaming is a big part of the state's economy, which means a 2-month closure was really significant.
It was significant. It hurt the cities that get tax money. It hurt the state that gets the tax money. But mostly it hurt the people. For some folks, that's, you know, that's their connection to the world. I had interviewed two women. They walk across the bridge that separates one town to another. It's about 3 miles. And every day they walk the bridge and they come into the Golden Nugget. So they had missed that. The staff, some of the employees had a really hard time because there were so many people filing for unemployment. You know, it went from 1,000 a week to 25,000-30,000 a week. So they just couldn't keep up. They didn't have diapers for their babies. They were emailing me, please help me. It was a hard time. But the casinos, they were in touch with them, is what the employees said, that they contacted them, made sure that they had gotten their unemployment, made sure that they were okay. So they did have that connection, but, you know, it was tough.
In light of COVID-19, though, there are some real fears, though, right? I mean, some people feel conflicted about going back to work.
They do. And some of them can't go back to work. Childcare is going to be a big issue because a lot of the summer camps aren't operating this summer. So they're scrambling to find a place to put their kids. They're not in school now. But yeah, it's a whole new world out there, and everybody's having to adjust, and this is something completely new. And a lot of them are very afraid. It is a gamble to decide, yes, I'm going to go back to work. But again, you know, we do have a high rate of poverty. People at the casinos, some of them make a very generous salary. Others not, you know, depending on if they're dealers, they make quite a bit of money. If they're room attendants, you know, they don't make quite as much. So some of them are making more on unemployment than they are when they typically work. But everybody just wants that certainty, some certainty. And as I say, some of them won't come back. They'll be afraid. And I think it's not just the casinos. I think people in every industry are having to make these same decisions. Do I go back to work? What's next for me?
That's Mary Perez. She's a business and casino reporter for the Biloxi Sun-Herald, joining us from Biloxi, Mississippi. Mary, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, let's head now to Michigan. As President Trump is today, he'll tour a Ford motor plant making ventilators. In the wake of Governor Gretchen Whitmer's announcement this morning of the slow reopening of the state starting today. Now, ahead of his trip, the president falsely claimed on Twitter that Michigan's Secretary of State was illegally mailing voting ballots to Michiganders. She wasn't. She was sending applications for mail-in ballots, just as her Republican counterparts in other states are doing. But the president threatened to withhold aid to the state, something Governor Whitmer addressed on CBS this morning.
Threatening to take money away from a state that is hurting as bad as we are right now is just scary, and I think something that is unacceptable.
The state is hurting from COVID-19 and flooding. 10,000 residents are displaced after two dams breached earlier this week. And Whitmer had written asking the president to declare a federal emergency in that area. But Trump has vilified Whitmer and tweeted support of protesters, many armed, enraged by her stay-at-home restrictions, even though those restrictions followed Trump administration guidelines. And did we mention Whitmer is being considered as Joe Biden's running mate? There's a lot to take up here. So let's bring in Rick Pluta, reporter with Michigan Public Radio. And Rick, briefly, this announcement today that Whitmer would be lifting some social restrictions on gatherings and businesses would slowly reopen. Tell us a little more about what she said.
Okay, well, Michigan has been operating under a what's called a stay-at-home order for weeks and weeks, although under this new stay-at-home order, which we're expecting next week, more people will be able to step out. Auto dealers will be allowed to resume seeing customers by appointment. Doctors, dentists, veterinarians will be able to see patients for non-essential services. And somewhat significantly now, gatherings of 10 people will be allowed, 10 or fewer will be allowed, but they still have to practice social distancing and other precautions.
Yeah, we're also seeing that retail businesses, many of them across the state, can reopen May 26 with some restrictions. Auto showrooms open by appointment May 26, veterinary services maybe May 29th. So, you know, we remember that President Trump's criticism of her is that she needed to liberate Michiganders. This kind of undercuts that as he heads to the state. But we have seen those protesters. Sure, people devastated by, you know, financially by the stay-at-home restrictions. Also Trump supporters who've openly said they just don't want her telling them what to do. But
right.
What do polls show, you know, about the support she has in her handling of COVID-19?
Well, we're seeing this in Michigan. We're also seeing this in other states, and that's with both Republican and Democratic governors. Whitmer is a Democrat, and by and large, people support the restrictions. They support these measures, these stay-at-home orders and whatnot, in order to tame the effects of COVID-19. And we should point out that politically that matters in Michigan because the election was so close here the last time around. The presidential election was so close here the last time around.
Right. Trump narrowly won in 2016.
0.23 of a percentage point.
That's narrow.
That's narrow.
Right. And we know the president is expected to tour this Ford Motor Plant. And yesterday, Michigan's attorney general said that under state law, he has a legal responsibility to wear a mask. The president has not worn a mask while visiting factories. And we also understood that there was a, you know, tie to this, that he would not be allowed to visit again. I mean, what's the talk there about? I'm sure people are watching. What's the talk about the mask and President Trump?
Well, I mean, talk, because obviously no one is going to try to take some kind of law enforcement action against the president of the United States visiting a factory. The governor, Governor Whitmer, has asked the president to use the opportunity to sign an emergency declaration for a separate national, a natural disaster in northern Michigan. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but that's kind of it. She has asked that in the future, should the president or the vice president visit, that they do abide by these restrictions, social distancing, masks.
Right. I just have to ask you very briefly, Rick.
Sure.
Governor Whitmer did confirm that she's talking with Joe Biden's campaign about being his running mate. Has she said, and again, just a couple seconds here, how, you know, is she considering it?
She said that she's focused right now on addressing the disasters in Michigan, because you're not going to get something like that if you fail in what's happening in your backyard.
Right. Michigan Public Radio reporter Rick Pluter, thank you. We officially have another month left of spring. It might seem like it's gone on forever, while at the same time never really starting because of COVID-19. Maybe your spring has been typically spring-like, cold one day, hot the next. What our classical music pal Fran Hoffner calls nature's fake-out, fool me once, shame on you, fool me every year since I'm born, shame on me. And she says Robert Schumann's Spring Symphony might be just the companion for your spring fever. Schumann wrote the piece in 1841 in the throes of wedding bliss and mania. And Fran Hoffner, our music opinionator, joins us to take a closer look at it. And Fran, first of all, you apologize for overlooking the music of Robert Schumann. And why were you overlooking it?
I have always paid a little bit more attention to Brahms, who's something of his apprentice slash, roommate for a period of time. And I think I prefer Brahms' steady melancholy sometimes to Schumann's frantic mania. But during a time in which mania is sort of everywhere, Schumann suddenly feels really appropriate.
Well, and also we've spoken here before about Clara Schumann. Schumann's wife, and maybe you were leaning a little more towards her, but now you say this is the kind of music that is perfect for people who are cooped up. Why is that?
You know, it flits about from huge, loud bursts of joy to quiet melancholy. It gives you the whole spectrum of human emotion, and if we can't spend a lot of time outside, out and about in the world, the next best thing is to just be able to listen to the full human experience.
And joy to melancholy just about describes my experience at home anyway. Well, let's take another listen. He's credited with writing some of the greatest romantic era music. Let's listen a little more to Spring, because some people have taken issue with Schumann's music over the years. You obviously are picking this one. Let's listen a little. We hear that triangle. You're partial to triangles and percussion.
I always am, yeah. It's an instrument no percussionist ever thinks they want to play until they have that part, and then it's the most fun thing in the world.
Well, but also we can hear a little of the mania there.
Absolutely. You know, Schumann's writing after Beethoven, so I think you can see some of the German classical influence in his work, but he's just blowing the emotionality all out of it.
Well, and he may actually have had bipolar disorder. And we're reading that in 1833, a few years before he wrote this symphony, he lost a brother and a sister-in-law to the worldwide cholera pandemic. So, you know, maybe we're feeling some of that in there as well. It sent him into a severe depression. I mean, the highs and lows there. So let's listen to what might be that side of him in the second movement, the Larghetto. Thank you. This is so contemplative. What are you hearing?
Well, first of all, I just think this is a really beautiful movement of a symphony, but it really captures a nice wistfulness and longing. Sort of reminds me of, you know, days like these are a little easier when the sun is out and I can go for a walk around the block. When it's pouring, as it does sometimes, I really feel like I'm just sitting at the window, like with my hand pressed to the glass, waiting to go back out. And that's what this movement is for me as well.
Well, but, you know, and when we remember what he's been through, you know, the loss of people in the cholera pandemic.
Yeah, that spring doesn't necessarily bring about happiness. It's often a time of reflection as things feel turbulent and ever-changing.
Well, and he had more sadness in his life. A self-inflicted injury trying to train his hand for piano cost him his performing career. He had to sue his future father-in-law and piano teacher to marry his much younger wife, Clara, the piano virtuoso who we've spoken of. Yikes! I mean, so what kind of a couple were they?
I mean, I think he often lived in the shadow of Clara's success, and when he had Brahms with him, I believe he was also living in the shadow of Brahms' success. He had a really sad and difficult life, and his work reflects that a lot of the time. I think Brahms gets the credit for being a more melancholy composer, but Schumann was contending with a lot of real material sadness in his work.
Well, but some people might say, wait a minute, spring is about hope and promise and everything's green and emerald. And there is some of that here. The third movement, the scherzo, gets us outside, I think, for a dance. Let's listen. What are you hearing here?
It's a lot of fun, but I think there's some fury to it as well. It has this blistering sort of nature, you know, sort of reminiscent of maybe high winds, branches clicking against each other as they burst into bloom.
Oh, see, so we haven't yet found the hope of spring here, have we?
not quite yet. Or he dangles it, but it's a little scary.
Well, let's listen to the last movement, the Allegro, as it moves along. Let's listen. Okay, so we're thinking maybe, okay, here we are, we're getting to daffodils popping and everything. But here's also where there's a lot of fake outs, fake endings here.
Yeah, you know, it'll speed up and build to something and then very quickly drop back down. But I think the speed of this particular movement also simulates the way spring. I feel like when it does finally happen, it happens in 2 days. It never takes a full 6 weeks of the season. It's like the flowers appear overnight, the leaves on the trees appear overnight, and this movement is all about the suddenness of that.
Well, and you know, you mentioned that there's a sort of pulling the rug out from under you aspect to this. It has like four false endings, and he had this us versus them thing, the people he called the artistic Philistines. And you know, we heard about how he had a sue to get his wife and crazy. What's he doing here with those false endings?
I think he's making fun of his audience a little bit. He definitely approached his music as putting himself on a pedestal, and it wasn't really his own responsibility if the audience got it or not. And so he's very willing to like play these tricks in order to have his own fun.
Yeah, let's listen. Perhaps a robin. Ah, it starts over. Fred, Fran Hoffner, Schumann may have gone mad at the end of his life from syphilis. And again, reminding us of things without cures. He claimed to have heard angelic voices, one note in his head. Maybe that was tinnitus. He threw himself into the Rhine River and was institutionalized. His doctors prevented Clara from seeing him for 2 years until just days before he died. Oh, you know, now that when you hear all this, yeah, it is, it's sad, but what does that add to listening to a piece like Spring?
It makes you really search for whatever joy he himself was seeking in writing something like this. He composed this symphony, you know, in the year or so leading up to his wedding, possibly one of the happiest and most productive times in his life. And it's really remarkable to see what he was capable of when he felt like he was pushing towards something good.
Yeah. Well, it's also a reminder of what can come out of a time like this, because he lived through a cholera epidemic, syphilis, mental illness, institutionalized. I mean, there's so many whiffs of what we see today, and we hear it in this beautiful piece, Spring by Schumann, through Fran Hoffner, our music opinionator. Fran, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Sports are starting to make a comeback. NASCAR racing again. The German Soccer League is playing games. And there will be live professional golf this weekend. One thing they all have in common, no fans. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, we should say no fans watching. They have fans. But how many tuned in? We saw soccer and NASCAR televised this weekend. What were the ratings?
Right. No fans there in the stadiums. At home, we're desperate. So you read press releases from, say, Fox Sports saying a record for Bundesliga, which is German soccer ratings. And I said to myself, I didn't even know the ratings used to be so high that they were measurable. So I don't know how much of an increase you could document. But there were 300 some on thousand Americans watching German soccer. And that's something. When you look at some of the other sports that Americans are more into and used to normally, you know, a UFC fight on ESPN drew very well, over a million. And the NASCAR race did tremendously well, over 6 million. So people are definitely desperate to watch some sports. And when the big team sports, if the big team sports come back, I think eyeballs will be on them.
Yeah, well, NASCAR, of course, the, you know, probably the most popular sport in the country, I think, you know, by some metrics. And you don't really need the, you know, the fans are, it's more the roar of the car. But I want to know, what about the boys of summer? Any news for baseball?
There's a lot of news, and Major League Baseball has come up with a very detailed plan. It might be optimistic. It's good that they're working on it. There, in fact, it is so detailed, and we talked about this last week. It would be segmented regionally to try to limit travel, but they put out 60-something pages of rule proposals, and some of these were so fine and picayune that many players objected. For instance, rules against spitting. Yes, it's good not to spit, but what if someone spits in a dugout? Will they be thrown out of the game? Rules against third base coaches arguing with umpires and the distance they'll be. But the big thing is, even though they got so detailed on these on-field rules or the proposals, the players are a little worried about testing because there was no provision that mandated daily testing, not just many times a week testing. And then there's the other issue of money, which is that the players say, you know, when the owners have a great year, we don't share in their upside. What we do is get paid a salary. So now Major League Baseball, the owners are saying, we'll split the very diminished proceeds from this year. And the players like, how come we have to experience the downside when the value of your franchise is increased? We don't get a cut of that. And I think the answer will have to be, this is a negotiating position and baseball's not ready to come back, but America needs baseball so much that the players will probably decide we're going to have to take some sort of haircut on this, or else there'll be no baseball because players are insisting on extremely high salaries in a time of depression level unemployment. I find that untenable. So in summary, a lot of details to be worked out in terms of contracts, and also some of these rules, we have to figure out how they'll actually work in real life.
Well, imagine that, how something will actually work in real life. Real quick, just in a couple seconds, yes or no, hockey and basketball soon?
Basketball might go with the bubble system, just Las Vegas and Orlando, all the teams there. But again, the virus has a lot to say about all of that.
Yeah.
Hockey,
a little
less certain.
Yeah. Mike, the virus has a lot to say. Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst, hosting the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
By now, many of you with scheduled doctors and therapy appointments have done them through video conferencing. Now, some addiction specialists say this message has actually improved the way they're able to help some patients. Our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication, recently highlighted this in a piece titled, COVID-19 Has Streamlined Addiction Medicine. Will the changes stick? We'll post that link at hereandnow.org. In the piece, STAT spoke with several addiction experts about telehealth resources and expanding their services during the pandemic. Among them was Dr. Stephen Lloyd from Tennessee. Thank you for joining us, Doctor.
Thank you, Tanya.
Well, Doctor, telemedicine is being used by providers in substance abuse disorder treatment. I'm wondering from you, how have you been able to incorporate this into your work since this outbreak began?
Tanya, we actually incorporated it very early on. At the very start, before our state, which I practice in Tennessee, before our state initiated the stay-at-home order. So we were already up and running as we, you know, anticipated this. But it's really, you know, I describe it as, you know, as letting the genie out of the bottle. One of the big blocks to people getting help with substance use disorder with medication is actually physically getting, you know, to and from the clinic because of a variety of things, not the least of which is not having a legal driver's license. And so whenever we incorporated this, the percentage of patients that we had showing up regularly for their scheduled appointments skyrocketed. I've had multiple days over the past month where I had 100% show rate, which was unheard of before the pandemic.
Oh, really? You know, those are details that we don't consider. Someone who does not have a driver's license, perhaps because of a DUI conviction, those types of things. Allowing you to be able to talk to them through teleconferencing really takes away that barrier. I also want to ask you about something else. You've said that telemedicine has also helped you gain insights into your patients' living situations. In a way, that makes sense, but how so?
Well, you know, you have patients that come into your office and you see them, you know, during that 15 or 20 minute time period, and that's what you know. You know, when they're doing this from home, I'm able to discover things that I didn't know before, living situations. So I think when I did the STAT News article, there had been two patients that I had discovered were actually homeless. They were living in their car. And, you know, of course, there's resources available to help those folks. And so I was able to identify that from just, you know, looking at them on, you know, on my computer screen. And then, you know, that's a delicate thing to talk about. You know, there's a lot of shame associated with that. And so able to broach that subject and then get those folks help. Since the article came out, I've actually found one more. Now, they weren't living in their car, but they were living, you know, basically hotel to hotel and couch to couch. And so it gave me insight that, you know, you can't get from a, you know, from a face that somebody puts on coming into your clinic because, you know, a lot of times just they're ashamed.
Mm. Are there any drawbacks that you've experienced?
Well, Tony, the biggest drawback is, you know, the people who know me know this is true. I am a relational human being, big time, and I think we all are. But that's the big drawback, is just that face-to-face interaction. And then a lot of folks, you know, really get help from support groups. It can be 12-step groups. It can be, you know, connection through, you know, sometimes religious organizations and there are various other things you get connection through. And I think whenever, you know, this happened, it's hard to recreate that on telehealth, although it's not impossible. I don't think that it totally replaces being able to get together face to face because of that, you know, direct human interaction. And I think those are, you know, for me, those are the main drawbacks.
I can imagine that. That makes a lot of sense. Have there also been challenges in prescribing medicine to your patients over FaceTime or other types of telemedicine services?
I feel almost guilty for saying this, but it's way better. Most of our clinics that I oversee and that I run, we use medication buprenorphine. A lot of people know as Suboxone. And there are multiple challenges with that. Diversion is a problem. You know, altering prescriptions, you know, sometimes can be an issue. But with what we're doing now, it's all done electronically. You know, and this was in the process of happening just on a really slow pace. But it actually makes prescribing easier. You know, I can see a patient, evaluate their needs, hook them up with their therapist or group therapy. And then, you know, right after it's over, they get an email with their next office visit without standing in line, you know, leaving the office, waiting on an appointment card, you know, traditionally that's written down with a date and time. And then all the while, the medication goes, you know, directly to their pharmacy via e-prescribing. And so we were doing some of that anyway, but now it's every patient. And the other thing is we've actually worked with some pharmacies that we can actually have patients' medications delivered directly to their door. So we're not even exposing them to be getting out and going into a pharmacy or exposing our pharmacy interaction with our patients.
The other downside, though, I want to ask you, are the people that work inside of a clinic or a hospital setting, they do rely on the patients to come in as part of their job, assessing and those types of things. Are they still needed in this telemedicine world?
The truth is all of them probably won't be. But that doesn't mean that you can't use them for other things. So a lot of the people that we hire are in recovery themselves, right? And some of them, it's difficult for them to find jobs because of, you know, our country's propensity to try to use the criminal justice system for drug treatment. And so they have charges that make, you know, in their past, that makes it hard for them to find a job. So we're talking about repurposing those folks into recovery coaches, a recovery support services, which we know are very important in, you know, in all phases of recovery, but it's essentially the first part of recovery. So now you talk about taking them out of jobs of checking patients in and out and then moving them into jobs where they can actually start to do some of the things that they've been trained in, because a lot of them are certified peer recovery specialists. So I think you still have the same number. I just think you become more able to enhance your recovery support services.
With all of this, do you see this system working after we are able to get back to going to in-person doctor visits?
Tony, I certainly hope so. This is a tool that we've had hopes for a long time. That was probably coming in small increments over the next few years, and the pandemic, you know, obviously has sped it up. But I certainly hope we have the opportunity to use this tool. And as I said before, it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle. You know, now that it's out there and we know what we can do, and really, whenever you're talking about people with opioid use disorder, it's about access to treatment. And I live in Metro Nashville, just right outside of Nashville, Tennessee. And a lot of my patients are not from Metro Nashville. They're from rural areas. And so now you're talking about being able to save them driving distances, 30, 45, some patients an hour each way in their car to and from the office. All these limitations that patients have, you know, that maybe you're struggling with jobs and don't have the money for gas and things like that. Now you're able to deliver that care really over the internet. It's really, for me, it has been a godsend for my folks in rural areas, and I certainly hope we don't get that tool taken away from us. But I can tell you one really positive thing that's already happened in Tennessee is our largest insurer, Blue Cross Blue Shield, made an announcement last Friday that they are going to continue telehealth services even after the pandemic. And I'm hoping that the other insurers fall in line around that, because that was such great news. I immediately screenshotted that headline and, you know, sent it to my peers that, you know, that feel the same way that I do.
That makes total sense as well, because you want your patients to be able to afford this type of service. And if their insurance requires them to be in person, that will change the dynamic.
Right. And I think that it's a tool. You know, do I want to replace all of my interactions with my patients with the, you know, telehealth platforms? No, I don't. I love the patient interaction. It's why I'm a doctor, you know, and to be honest with you, a lot of times it feeds me, you know, in that personal interaction. And because my patients do well, you know, I was telling somebody earlier today, my favorite visit is the second one. Because the second one, I get to see how far somebody came in just a few days, and it's really amazing. And so I think that that's hard to replace on a computer. And so I think that, you know, there'll still be that doctor-patient interaction, but this is a huge supplement and allows us to deliver care in rural areas that otherwise is very, very difficult to deliver.
That's Dr. Stephen Lloyd, an addiction expert in Tennessee. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
We've heard from adults over the edge from having to teach their kids at home for the last few months. Well, it turns out some kids are losing it too. Exhibit A, Ginger Lidsky, 8 years old, a third grader at the Washington Irving School in Sleepy Hollow, New York. Yes, home to the legends of Sleepy Hollow. She's had it with technology and don't get her started on ELA, the English Language Arts Writing apps. She wrote an opinion piece in Fast Company where she might have had an in. Her dad's an editor. It's titled, Homeschooling Desperately Needs a Redesign. I should know. I'm in third grade. And she joins us from home. And Ginger, you've finished your online work for today, right?
Yes.
Okay, we want to make sure we're not taking away from your work.
Although we would much enjoy that.
That's what it sounds like. You do not like this at all. Why? Just spill it out.
Like, really, we don't like all the various apps. Today we had to do two different Flipgrid things for our writing thing, and it's just not fun.
Flipgrid.
Do you want to tell her what happened, how many times we had to redo it?
For the first one, we had to do it over three times, actually.
Okay, so now, Ginger, that's your mom, Carol, there. Carol. One of the things Ginger writes is, the worst part is I'm not really learning anything except for my mom's swear words.
Yeah, I like how she makes it seem like it's a rare treat to hear a swear word from me. And now it's just a party of swear words.
But Ginger, you're very serious about this. You want to learn and you feel that you're just not. You run through some of the technology, Google Classroom. Once you get through your work, you have to save it. And it doesn't often save, or as you write, worst thing ever.
The weird thing about the save thing, it doesn't automatically save. You press the save button, you have to wait like 30 seconds or something. And like, you'll be doing the work, and lots of people, they send us ridiculous messages, and you swipe at it, like the message, to make it go away, but then it'll bring you on to that page from whoever sent it to you. And then when you get back, if you didn't already save the work, then it'll all be gone. It should automatically save. Like Google Docs, sometimes it'll save like part of your work, but you can't even edit it.
Terrible, terrible. You write about Zoom and Google Meet. Some kids who have class on Zoom spend the whole time asking, hey, how'd you get that background? Or can anyone see me? I mean, we understand this. This is like our morning meetings. It's very tough.
Mm-hmm.
Do people forget to mute themselves?
Yeah, every time we have like a meet on there, then like every single time Eliana in our class is going to be asked, hey, turn the microphone off. Can you turn the microphone off? We're still hearing you. Can you turn the microphone off? Every meeting.
I know. But Ginger, what's the solution? Because you know that New York State has been hit hard by COVID-19. You know, what is the solution in your opinion?
I would suggest, like, oh my God, I wish they would just quit it with the ELA thing. Like, okay, couldn't they just do the read your book for something minutes, forget, like, the ridiculous writing things for ELA. And for the math, so we have this math homework book that they gave us to in English, so why can't we just do the math there? I don't get it.
In the book.
And for God's sake, we know social studies. Just quit it with the social studies. We don't care about social studies.
Oh. And while we're on a roll here, you have an issue with robots?
Yeah. They had these ridiculous math videos with robots in them. They act like we're kindergartners. These art videos that sometimes you get. Again, kindergarten level, not third grade.
Exactly. Carol, Mom. I mean, how hard is this for you if your 8-year-old disdains the technology and really wants to learn?
We will have we make a lot of deals, and there's a lot of bargaining and breaks and going outside and playing in the mud between the apps. You know, we have exercises from the gym teacher.
We skip those.
Yeah, we just skip those and we say we do it. Because, you know.
You can't do gym online.
There's only so much you can do. she's learning to navigate what you really need to do to fulfill your job and what you can kind of avoid doing, and it's not that big of a deal. And we will often, after the official lesson, then have our own. We'll do a science project.
I really hate home math projects.
Yeah. We'll do our own stuff because so much of the online learning is you must do this thing in this app, and most of our time is spent just wrestling with the app. I don't make her read horrible things.
Yeah, you do.
I just want her to read things she hasn't read before.
Don't. Carol. Don't.
Yeah.
That's Carol and Ginger Litsky of Sleepy Hollow, New York. Just a little glimpse into the hostage taking that the stay at home has become for many parents. Ginger, your mom's just trying to help. Give her a break. Carol, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Ginger, bye.
Oh, bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Tanya, did you ever?
It's my second full-time job. This little girl times two in my house. Actually,
I'm Robin Young.
Oh, I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.